You're listening to the Tipton Children Podcast.
Good evening, everyone. Let's cultivate our motivation first. Somehow, miraculously, we're all alive today. And we all have the karma ripening to be able to listen to teachings and share the Dharma today together. This is all, when you really think about it, quite an extraordinary experience. Because it's not easy to meet the Dharma, it's not easy to find the time to listen to the Dharma. It's not easy to have interest in the Dharma and to care about things beyond our own happiness of this life. And yet we have those conditions today, so it's really fortunate. And it's important that we make good use of these conditions and not take them for granted. Because we don't know, by next Thursday we could be in another realm with no chance to listen to the Dharma. And so, now that we have this opportunity to make our life meaningful, let's do it, and do it in the best way by generating the bodhicitta motivation. And so really aiming to attain full awakening for the benefit of all beings. No matter who they are, whether we like them or don't like them, to remember their kindness, to work for their benefit, and to do that by fulfilling our own and others' spiritual purposes. Okay, so we've been talking about Nagarjuna's precious garland, a teaching that he gave to a king, and that many people consider it part of his collection of reasonings, you know, texts in which he speaks of the reasoning that refutes inherent existence and proves emptiness. And most people see the text like that, but there's lots of parts of the text that don't pertain to that topic too, so some other people consider it part of his collection of advice, which are his texts where he's giving more advice to people on how to live. So the main topic of Precious Garland is upper rebirth and the highest good. So upper rebirth, having a good rebirth, and the highest good, meaning liberation and full awakening. And we have to work to attain them in that order, because it's going to take a series of upper rebirths for us to create the causes to attain full awakening. And so we have to first create the cause for that upper rebirth, and then by having a series of upper rebirths, continue to practice and in that way eventually attain full awakening. And so this first chapter is specifically about how to do that, and he has already been talking about the qualities of faith and wisdom, or faith, it's really not a good word, confidence, trust, yeah, and wisdom being the two critical components that we need. So needing faith or confidence in the functioning of the law of karma and its effects, you know, and by understanding that, then abandoning non-virtue, creating virtue, so we can attain a series of good upper rebirths. And then wisdom being the ultimate quality that we need to generate, because that's going to be the thing that enables us to attain the highest good and to be free of cyclic existence once and for all. Okay, so then he started going more specifically into what are the causes for upper rebirth, and that's the section that we're on now. And so he was talking about 16 factors that are things that we need to practice, in order to attain an upper rebirth. Yeah? So the first 10 were to abandon the 10 non-virtues. So we talked about that last time. Yeah? And so abandoning the 10 non-virtues is just not doing them, and it's also doing the opposite. Okay, so two ways to, or should I say, better two ways to do the create the 10 virtues. One is by abandoning the 10 non-virtues, stopping ourselves before we engage in them, and then the other is by doing the opposite. Okay, so you want to? Shall we run through? Let's go in a line, and we'll go. You know, everybody has to. Name one. So you start. Start. Do them in order. Mm-hmm.
Taking what hasn't been freely given.
Okay.
Engaging and wise through David.
Yeah.
Intoxicants.
Mm.
Nope.
Nope. Mm. We're talking about the 10. We're not talking about the 5 precepts.
Lying.
Yeah. No lying.
Harsh speech.
No. Divisive speech, okay.
Harsh speech.
Uh-huh.
No speech.
Idle talk.
Idle talk, okay.
Laziness.
No. No, do you know it?
I know wrong view, but that's not the right order.
No. What are the 3 mental ones? Okay, do you know it? You know?
Jealousy.
Covetousness.
That's not the same thing?
No, coveting is wanting other people's stuff. Jealousy is not being able to endure their happiness. Okay, so coveting?
Wrong or false views.
Yeah, wrong views. Okay. Okay, so we can tell who didn't review their notes.
Why is this in order? Why is there any?
Why is there the order? Because the 3 of body go from the most severe to the lightest. The 4 of speech also from the most severe to the lightest. The 3 of mind from the lightest to the heaviest. Okay, so it's reminding us of, you know, just as an action itself, yeah, the natural negativity of it. Okay, so then we're on, the next outline is ceasing other blameworthy actions. Okay, so so there's 3 of these that we want to cease. Yeah, the lines from Precious Garland say, in brief, Dharma consists of not taking intoxicants, maintaining a proper livelihood, and abandoning harm. Okay, so that's the first part of the verse. The second part of the verse is 3 practices to engage in, and so the 3rd and 4th lines say, being respectfully generous, honoring the worthy, and cultivating love. Okay, so let's go back to the first part. The first 2 lines of the verse that have to deal with ceasing other blameworthy actions. So it lists 3 of them. Not taking intoxicants, okay, maintaining a proper livelihood, and abandoning harm. Okay, so not taking intoxicants, that's fairly clear. So it's alcohol and then recreational drugs. Yeah, if you have a prescription from a doctor take your meds. Okay? No problem with taking meds. That's not what's being talked about here. Unless somebody is abusing meds, like getting prescriptions for oxycodone, yeah, as I say it right, that aren't really needed, and, you know, getting addicted to pills and things like that. So it could be a legal drug that's getting abused, or it could be an illegal drug that's getting abused. But in either case, the motivation is, you know, basically to, you know, what's it, tune out. Yeah, tune out, turn on. Yeah, and basically numb our feelings, numb our mind. And so, you know, the reason this is so disadvantageous is because we can't think clearly when we're intoxicated. And so as a result, we make many dumb decisions. Yeah, so there's the story, you know, I don't think it's a real story, but it's a good story about somebody who, you know, captured a monk and wanted to humiliate him and said, okay, you either have to kill this sheep or sleep with this woman or drink this bottle of alcohol. And he thought, well, killing the sheep is naturally negative, you know, having sex, thus he's going to break his vows doing that. So, you know, having the alcoholic drink is not a naturally negative action, so he decided to do that, and then he did the other two. Okay? So I think we've all had enough experience with drugs and alcohol. I'm sure we could probably write a book of funny experiences, you know? Yeah? And stupid things we did while we were intoxicated. And, you know, and just see that it's useless, you know? It doesn't make our life any better. It makes our mind confused. We wind up creating more problems for ourselves and doing and saying things when we're intoxicated that afterwards, when our mind is a little bit clearer, we feel tremendously embarrassed about. Okay? So I think we can see the disadvantages of intoxicants. What's very interesting is that when it comes to taking precepts, you know, the five lay precepts, the fifth one about no intoxicants, that's the one more people falter on and decide not to take than any other one. You know, okay, a killing, stealing, sleeping around, lying, okay, you know, but intoxicants, and they have all sorts of reasons, yeah. Well, because my family likes to have a little bit of wine on holidays. Yeah. Sounds good, as if, you know, and my family won't like it if I don't drink the wine on holidays. Yeah. What about having grape juice? I went through my whole childhood having grape juice at Seder's. You know? It's fine, you drink grape juice, nobody cares. It looks like wine, and it's not. Yeah. But, you know, people, and so many people come and say, you know, I don't really want to drink, but if I don't drink, people will think I'm very strange, and they'll think Buddhism is a very prudish religion, or, you know, I have to drink to close the business deal because we always go out, you know, for food and drink, and that's how we sign the papers, and so my business is going to fail if I don't drink. And they have all these things, but they all say, but I really don't want to drink. Yeah. So it gives me the feeling sometimes that maybe at all these parties nobody really wants to drink, but they're all drinking because they all think everybody else is going to think they're weird if they don't drink. Yeah, but the excuses, and I could think it's excuses, to tell you the truth, you know, is it's amazing, you know, that people really think, like if you go to a family thing and you don't drink, that, you know, the whole family, you know, all 30 people are going to stop and stare at you and point a finger and say, they didn't drink that liquor. Terrible. You know, I mean, is that really going to happen in your family? Do you think after the get-together, you know, or after the party, the next day when everybody is waking up for their hangovers, when they're all texting each other about what great a party it was, that the next line after how great it was, did you notice that so-and-so didn't drink? Do you really think that that's all they're going to talk about? And therefore, Buddhism is a very prudish religion. You know, all these Buddhists came to my party, they didn't drink. That's what they're going to text about the next morning when they wake up from their hangover. Right? You know, come on. Come on. So, you know, this whole thing of you know, protecting one's reputation, and protecting the reputation of Buddhism. You know, you've forgotten that seeking reputation is one of the eight worldly concerns to be abandoned. Yeah. Oh, and then the next one is, you know, after those ones don't work, then the next one is, but you know, I'm trying to benefit them. And so to benefit people and get them interested in the Dharma, I have to mix with them socially. Yeah, otherwise they won't talk with me. So we all go out drinking and drugging together, and then I can talk about the Dharma and they get interested in the Dharma. That sounds very good. It's a bodhisattva action. Really? It's a bodhisattva action? Yeah, so you hear enough of these that you just kind of, when people do it, it's like, oh, yawn. And, and okay, I'm not going to fight with you. If you don't want to take the fifth precept, don't take the fifth precept. But now what I do is I joke with them. It's like, oh, so you're going to go, you know, everybody else here is taking the fifth precept. You aren't, so you're going to go and have a drink to celebrate taking refuge in precept afterwards. They like that one. Yeah. So, you know, just think about it. Okay. So, it is, you know, people say, well, you're a nun. Yeah. But I wasn't born a nun. Yeah. I know about intoxicants, you know. And I know how totally boring it gets. It does, doesn't it? You know? You get loaded, same old thing, you know. Yeah, you know, you have your turtle race, you have your whatever you're doing. Didn't you have turtle races? Oh, we had turtle races. And, you know, the turtles raced along the floor. The problem was that we had neighbors below. They didn't like the turtle races.
Turtles
Yeah, it makes a lot of noise because turtles, you know, were like, you didn't do turtle races. Come on, you were in the Navy. Oh. What did you do?
Depended on where we were.
You got in the boats and went for rides.
That's true, yeah.
Okay, so. Okay, let's go on to the next one. Yeah?
So, why did Marco think that Milarepa was a great candidate after he plowed his field and drank his beer?
Because, why did Marco think that Milarepa was a great candidate after he plowed the field and drank the beer? Because he was seeing if Milarepa was willing to follow his teacher's instructions, and if Milarepa was capable of doing things that are normally prohibited with a bodhicitta motivation. Yeah. But Marpa also threw Milarepa out of teachings many, many times, didn't he? Yeah, and said, you lazy bum, get out of here. Yeah. But what the great yogis do and what we do are two different things. Yeah. Their actions are things that it's very difficult for us to understand because they all have all sorts of symbolic meaning. And it's done by minds that have bodhicitta and realization of emptiness. Okay, so it's quite different from what we do. I mean, you should hear the teachings of, what was it, what Talopa made Marpa do, Naropa do. I mean, just amazing things. But as His Holiness says, if your teacher is the quality of Talopa and you're the quality of Naropa, then it's okay. But check up. Okay? Then the second thing of the other three blameworthy actions was, the second thing to practice was to maintain a proper livelihood. Okay, so for lay people, this means not deceiving people in business, not cheating them, not lying to them. You know, again, I have many people come to me and say, but if I don't lie, then I won't sell the product, you know? And, I mean, I can't tell you how many people come to me with that. Actually, recently somebody asked me when I go to Singapore if I would give a whole talk about business ethics. Yeah. But one of the things I remember about this, whenever people come and say, you know, but I've got to lie in order to do business, yeah, I tell them about my friend Linnea, who some of you met. She visited a couple of weeks ago. She was an executive for Levi Strauss in Hong Kong. And so I asked her about this, you know. And she said, when you lie to your customers, they always find out, and then they don't come back. If you tell your customers the truth, they appreciate it, they trust you, they come back and they tell other people. So she said, in the long run, telling your customers the truth is more profitable if you're looking in terms of just business value than lying to people and trying to get a quick deal right now. Yeah. And you can see that because all of us are like that. If we have to deal with somebody and we find out that that person's been lying to us or cheating us, are you going to go back to them and do business again? Forget it. Yeah. Whereas if somebody, you know, really cares about you as a customer, as a client, and tells you the truth, then you can have a good business relationship over many, many years. Okay. So for lay people, not lying, not cheating. If you borrow money, repaying that exact amount. If somebody borrows money from you, don't ask them for more than they really borrowed. You know. And then also engaging in occupations that don't involve harming people. Okay. So not doing a business that builds warplanes, that builds toxic chemicals, things like this. Yeah, having a livelihood that doesn't harm, that doesn't kill. Okay, you know, clearly not being a pimp, you know, things like that. Okay, then for monastics, right, livelihood is a little bit different because we don't work for money for a living. So the idea is how you procure the four requisites of food, shelter, clothing, and medicine. Okay? And so for monastics, there's five wrong livelihoods that we're to abandon in procuring the requisites for life. Okay? There's different lists of these five, and there's a list of four, and anyway, okay, so, but the first one is hypocrisy. Here in the list is Kensa Jumpa Tekto gave it. So hypocrisy, you know, usually you sleep late, you hurry through your sadhanas, you don't make offerings, but your benefactor is coming, so you get up early, you make a really beautiful offering on your altar, you take out your Dorji and bell and your puja and you start looking like you're a serious meditator. But it's all hypocritical because that's not how you usually practice. Okay, so doing that with the motivation that then the benefactor will give you something is considered wrong livelihood. Okay, then flattery is the second one. Yeah, so here saying such nice, sweet words to people. I haven't seen you in so long. It's so good to see you again. I was worried that maybe you were sick, you haven't come by. So of course, if you're genuinely interested in the person and you haven't seen them, of course, ask about that. But here it's like feigning to care about somebody that you don't really care about. Or it could be flattery in the sense of, oh, you were so generous, you know, you were just really, really generous. I appreciate it so much. So again, you know, if you're really appreciating somebody's generosity, it's one thing, you know, to thank them. But this is doing it with a motivation of, you know, kind of getting something in return. Yeah. Then the third one is hinting. So this is done with an ulterior motivation. It's quite interesting because when I was a little kid, I was kind of taught to flatter people to get things and hint to get things because asking things straight out was not polite. Yeah, I don't know if any of you were taught that or not. But, you know, hinting like, oh, you know, the food you brought, the chocolate chip cookies in specific, the chocolate mint ice cream that you brought last time was so delicious. The whole community really enjoyed it. You know, hint, 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 hint. Okay. Or, you know, the jacket you gave me last year was really warm. You know, I wore it all winter, and now it's just in shreds, you know. So, of course, you know, again, if you appreciate something, it's fine to express your appreciation. But this is when you're hinting, again, you know, saying nice things to get something in return. Okay, then pretentious behavior. So here you're pretending to be what you aren't. Yeah. So you say something like, here's the example he gave. I heard you were supporting your parents, and that's wonderful. But what would you do if an arhat came to your house? Insinuating I'm an arhat, you know? Kind of, yeah. Or, you know, I went to this other house, and those people made offerings to me like they would to an arhat. You know, so it's this kind of insinuation and pretentious behavior. Again, you can see it's rotten. The motivation's totally rotten for doing this. And then five is misusing your property to get more. So this could be you give somebody a small gift to get a big one. You know, here's this satsa. We're giving you a satsa. Yeah, kind of, you know, there's the Donna basket. Yeah, something like this. So it's kind of like bribery, you know, you're giving a small gift. Yeah, but again, you know, there's nothing wrong with giving gifts to express your appreciation. But when you do it with the motivation to, you know, get somebody to give you something, then it's really rotten. Or another thing is, another example is, you know, your alms bowl is kind of falling, another way of misusing your property is you take out your alms bowl and you say, oh, this person who's very high in the government gave it to me. Or, you know, Michael, what was the game? There was some basketball player, Michael Jordan, Phil somebody, Jackson. Yeah, they gave me this. Yeah. Or Goldie Hawn, or, you know, Michael Sclerosis. Or, oh, Richard Gere. Richard Gere gave me this. Yeah? So it's like, you know, this then, so you're taking your possession out. Look what Richard gave me. So that's like, you know, important people give me things, so don't you want to be an important person like those, because I'm an important person because I receive things from important people. Okay? So that kind of behavior again. Yeah? So monastics are supposed to be humble. We're supposed to cultivate, contentment with what we have. Yeah? And not always have a mind that constantly wants to upgrade something. Yeah? Like, I wore my jacket for one season, so I need a new jacket. You know, I wore my shoes 1 year, I need new shoes. You know, we should really, use things well and only get things when we really need them, you know, and not have more clothes than we need, and we should not live better than our benefactors do. Okay. So those were the third one, third blameworthy action was when it says to cease the blameworthy actions, to relinquish physically and verbally harming other people. Okay? So not to beat them up, you know, slap them, you know, do something physically that harms them, or to harm them verbally. Yeah? So destroying their possessions, humiliating them, embarrassing them, yeah, making them feel inadequate, you know. And again, having the motivation to really harm others. If you don't have that motivation, but somebody completely misinterprets what you're doing, that's something you can't control. Okay, so these three other things, to abandon taking intoxicants, to abandon wrong livelihood, and then to abandon harming others physically and verbally. Okay? Then, three practices to engage in. So these are the last two lines of verse 10. Being respectfully generous, honoring the worthy, and cultivating love. That's what the verse says. Okay? So in addition to those 13 to abandon, there's these three to do. So respectful generosity is making offerings to those who are worthy of respect. Okay? And so people offering to people in a respectful manner, and to people who are worthy of respect. So who's worthy of respect? Okay? Our preceptors, our spiritual mentors, okay, and sentient beings in general. Okay. And then rather than ask other people to make offerings for us, which we do, like if we can't go somewhere, you know, we may give somebody something to, you know, and say, get them this and give it for me because I can't go there. But if you are there, it's better to give by yourself, you know, give and to give respectfully, so to give with both hands. Yeah. So especially if you're serving, you know, your teacher or, you know, a guest teacher here at the Abbey, if you're carrying a dish, you know, you offer it with both hands like this. Yeah. You don't just have a dish in one hand, put it down as you're turning away to go somewhere else. Okay. Kind of like, yeah, here. Yeah. But also you don't need to make it like, look at me, I'm offering you some potatoes, you know. I mean, you just do it respectfully without making a big deal, okay? So it's also good just to remember the four kinds of generosity in general, to do them, so giving material possessions, and then giving fearlessness, so protecting those who are in danger. Giving love and support and encouragement, the third, and giving the Dharma, which is said to be the highest one. That's the fourth. Okay, so respectful generosity is the first of the three things. Yeah, then honoring the worthy is showing respect to those who are superior to us in virtuous qualities. Okay, so these are our preceptors, our spiritual mentors, and then there may be other people who are not our particular preceptor or spiritual mentor, but who are very, you know, who spiritually are very well respected and have a lot of good qualities. So to show those people honor and respect. Okay. And then love, the third one, is to, it's actually symbolizing here all four immeasurables. It's saying love, which is the first one, but it implies also cultivating compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. Okay, so you can see, you know, when we're talking about obtaining a precious human life, yeah, why all these 16 are important. You know, by practicing the first 10, then we keep good ethical conduct, which is the cause of upper rebirth, yeah. And then by not, you know, by abandoning intoxicants, we create the cause to have a clear mind, yeah. By a clear mind, a good intelligence. By abandoning wrong livelihood, we create the cause to have the possessions we need to do our practice, you know, because if you're born very poor, it becomes difficult to practice. By abandoning harming others physically and verbally, then we will have a healthy body and we'll have good relationships with other people. Okay. By being generous, then we'll have the material wherewithal to be able to practice and to create merit also by being generous. By honoring the worthy, then people will be attracted to us. You know, we'll have Dharma friends, we'll have a good relationship with the teacher, we'll have good relationships with sentient beings so we can benefit them in the future lives. And then cultivating the four immeasurables also will have good relationships with other people. And we'll also have a peaceful mind. Yeah, because if we have love and compassion, sympathetic joy and equanimity, then our mind's going to be very peaceful and tranquil. Okay, so this is all creating good qualities, you know, here specifically for getting a good rebirth so that we can continue to practice. Of course, doing all of these in general, if you do them with a bodhicitta motivation, then it you know, the positive potential from it, the merit, won't be exhausted until you attain full awakening. So don't just because these things are taught in the section about attaining an upper rebirth, don't just think, okay, my motivation for doing them is an upper rebirth. I don't have to generate bodhicitta. Because if you think like that, then you're missing out on an extraordinary opportunity to again create bodhicitta again and again and again and make that strong imprint in your mind and to have the merit be inexhaustible until, you know, full awakening is attained. Okay, then the next section is a summary. So, that's what we just did, the 13 practices to abandon and the 3 practices to engage in, so 16 altogether, will, you know, act as the causes for an upper rebirth. And ethical conduct is the heart of doing that. So there's a lot to think about in these 16 and to really, you know, do a little life review and see how we relate to all 16 of these, whether we practice the ones to practice, whether we abandon the ones to abandon. Yeah, so really it apply it to our own life. And that'll give us some direction about what we need to really take care about in our practice. Okay, then the next section is called Engaging in Imperfect Paths Harms Oneself and Others. So this is talking about following wrong paths based on wrong views, okay? Following unsuitable paths. And there are a dime a dozen All you have to do is pick up any New Age newspaper in town, and there's so many new paths, you know, invented last Tuesday, or maybe a few years ago. Some of them, you know, invented by Charlotte Tananda, you know, who's making a good deal of money. You'll remember the whole Jim Jones fiasco from years ago, where he told his disciples to kill themselves, and they did it. You know, then there's, I mean, all sorts of things of, you know, wrong teachers and wrong paths. So here Nagarjuna is really warning us against that, okay? So verse 11, Nagarjuna says, Dharma does not come about merely through engaging in physical austerities. Through that type of practice, one neither ceases harming others, nor does one benefit them. Okay, so especially at the time of the Buddha, there were a lot of non-Buddhists who did physical austerities. And even nowadays, people will get into doing extreme physical austerities. I mean, in Catholicism, it was quite popular until the Second Vatican. Did they make, like, self-flagellation illegal, or... They did. Yeah, but beforehand, you know, people were encouraged to self-flagellate and, you know, go in the ice-cold water and...
Horsehair shirts. Huh?
Horsehair shirts and all sorts of things, you know. The idea being that if you make the body suffer, then you will tame the attachment to the body. But that doesn't work. You know, and throughout history, I mean, like I said, at the Buddha's time too, people were doing all sorts of ascetic practices, and the Buddha himself even tried it. You know, there's the famous statue of the Buddha, you know, where he looks like a skeleton. I think it's in Pakistan. You know, because he ate for 6 years, all he ate was one grain of rice a day. And he was so thin, when he touched his belly button, he could feel his spine, and he looked like a skeleton. And, you know, these kind of practices of torturing the body don't conquer attachment to the body at all. All they do is make the body suffer. And especially if you're practicing Tantra, you're not allowed to harm your body in that. And in general, we're encouraged to keep our body healthy. Yeah, not by self-indulging it, okay? So this is not a talk on, you know, how to go in for self-indulgence. Like, well, she said, you know, don't do ascetic practices, and to take care of your body, so now I'm going to sleep, you know, 12 hours a day, and I'm going to tell the kitchen manager to get all the food I like, and I need, you know, my bed to be exactly like this, and I want some really soft slippers, because otherwise my little fussies get sore, and, you know, I need a special heater and air conditioner in my room, because it's got to be the right temperature. Okay, it sounds like being a normal American. Yeah. Yeah, but we're very self-indulgent in this country. Okay, so I'm not going on something for self-indulgence, but it's just don't do ascetic trips with the idea of harming your body to knock out the attachment, because that's not how you do it. You have to get rid of attachment to the body through your internal meditation. Yeah, through contemplation of emptiness, through contemplation of the nature of dukkha, through contemplation of impermanence. Okay. So these the question sometimes comes, you know, do non-Buddhists have methods for attaining rebirth? And so Nagarjuna says, yes, they do, but the methods don't work, you know, because these people are being told to do these ascetic practices and they'll get an upper rebirth, but it doesn't really bring the upper rebirth. Yeah. And so there's stories, when you read the Pali scriptures, there's stories of some of these non-Buddhists, they would be practicing acting like a dog, the idea being that if you act like a dog, that you use up all your low, your bad karma, and then you'll have an upper rebirth. So they would come see to the, these human beings would come see the Buddha crawling on all fours. They would, you know, lick their food with their mouth. They would curl up like a dog in front of the Buddha. Yeah. Because that was their ascetic practice. And still, you know, if you go to Rishikesh in India now, there's a lot of, or at least there used to be a lot of these kind of ascetics, people who would stand on one foot for years and years and years. Yeah. So these kinds of practices. Yeah. So the Buddha said, you know, tried all these things, and he said, look, they don't work. So keep your body healthy, but don't indulge it. Okay? So so then somebody may say, you know, well, what about doing nune? Yeah? Isn't that kind of, you know, I mean, austere practices, a lot of people fast to conquer the body. Nune, you know, if you're doing a series of nunes, then you only eat one meal, one meal and a light breakfast every other day. Isn't that kind of, you know, austerities? No, yeah, because it's, you can keep your body healthy doing that. And our motivation is a motivation of compassion. And we're doing that to increase our compassion for sentient beings, increase our refuge, okay? And so we're also meditating on emptiness and generating ourselves as the deity in the form of the deity at that time. So it isn't just self-torture for the sake of self-torture at all, okay? And then you do get to eat. Okay, so... you know, verse 11, you know, the basic thing is that doing all those kind of ascetic practices, you don't cease causing others harm, and in fact you're harming yourself. So there's no use to those things. Yeah, they don't benefit others, they don't benefit yourself. Okay. Then the next verse is people who go on the wrong path. So it says, one who does not respect the great path of the true Dharma with its manifest generosity, ethical conduct, and fortitude follows the mistaken path of inflicting hardship on the body, just as a cow in a herd follows the line of cattle in front. Okay, so here Nagarjuna is talking about, not only do people do these practices that don't help themselves and don't help others, but they teach these wrong practices to other people. And that's really negative, because then you're not only harming yourself, but you're actively leading others astray and leading others on the wrong path. Okay? And so he's comparing it to a line of cattle. You know, you might have a whole group of cattle. If you've ever been to India, if you watch the cattle or watch the sheep, you know, they all kind of move in a herd. But there's often one leader. And if the leader, you know, there might be like a whole big meadow and a nice beautiful place to walk, but the leader takes this very narrow path that's walking near a cliff, or takes a path that takes you into a deep jungle with a lot of snakes and vines and so on, and all the other animals just follow the leader, you know? Kind of the first cow goes there, so all the cows follow. Yeah? So it's like peer pressure with human beings, or it's like, you know, well, somebody else did it, it must be okay. Yeah? Somebody else told me I could do it, so, you know, I'll do it.
Is this like what we say, the blind leading the blind?
Yeah, it's kind of like the blind leading the blind. Yeah, so somebody here is doing a harmful practice, thinking that it's a practice that creates merit, and other people follow them. Yeah, so here's where you get Charlatananda in your New Age newspaper. Yeah. you know, that just different people that you, that, you know, there was one guy who said he was Maitreya Buddha, and, you know, everybody was giving him all his money, all their money, and, you know, there's all sorts of different weird things kind of going on, okay? Somebody else who was Dorje Chang the third, or the second, or something, I don't know. But, you know, and then people who do all sorts of stuff with, you know, exorcisms and fortune telling and all kinds of, you know, stuff like that. So then people follow the wrong path, and you know, they wind up not only wasting their time, but often creating a lot of negative karma. And then the thing is that they followed this path so assiduously, thinking that it was a good path, and then they're expecting at the time they die that they're going to have a beautiful death, but they're not, because the ripening of the karma, you know, the karmic visions that are going to happen to them at the time of death are going to be awful. And then they completely lose faith at that time in all spirituality, and just kind of then think, well, you know, all spirituality is just a big hoax. And so that's really sad when that happens at the time of death for somebody, because then they put all their life energy into something, they realize it was rotten, then they generalize to all spiritual practice and throw the whole kit and caboodle out of the window. Yeah, so quite sad. So, you know, what Nagarjuna is saying here is, you know, don't follow this kind of person, and also don't be this kind of person who leads people astray. The thing is, you know, that people who lead people astray, I don't know that they're consciously thinking, you know, I think I'm going to lead people astray. I think, you know, somehow the mind is very convoluted, and they think what they're doing is really good. Yeah? Or they think that they don't have to follow that somehow they're holier than other people, they don't need to follow the rules that other people follow. Yeah? You know, because there were some scandals and some years ago about some of the evangelical Christians who would talk hellfire and brimstone about sex, and then it's found out that they're sexually abusing young boys. And, you know, so I'm sure these people, they had some reasoning going on in their mind why what they were doing was okay, you know? But I don't know. I think in some way people always think that what they're doing is okay. Yeah. Kind of, even if you're, you know, you think you're Maitreya Buddha and everybody will create so much good karma giving all their money to me. Yeah, so give me all your money and then you create, you know, unlimited merit and you make a connection with Maitreya Buddha for your next life. It sounds really good, doesn't it? You know? But then somebody who's not Maitreya Buddha thinks they're Maitreya Buddha, and, you know, and it becomes a big mess. Okay? So, you know, really, when you look, it's, I think, for me anyway, I always look at the people who are really humble, not the people who make a big deal about themselves. And you look at His Holiness, He's always very humble. You know, He always treats everybody, you know, very equal, very much the same. Our teacher, Geshe Zopa, complete humility. Yeah, I mean, very erudite and realized, but no big thing on the outside. Yeah, and Geshe Eshe Topten, also, his robes were always kind of, you know, his shemdop was crooked and his socks were falling down and he had a few whiskers and, you know, and he would walk around do the lingkor around the palace and people thought some old monk. He was really an exceptional yogi, yeah? So these kind of people who really practice very sincerely but don't make a big deal about themselves. So those are the people, I think, who are, you know, we should look to when we're looking for proper teachers. Yeah. Okay, so the 16 practices can be summarized in three. Yeah, so ethical conduct, generosity, and fortitude. So the first three of the far-reaching practices. Yeah, so the 16, they encompass all 16 practices. And then if we, you know, really make those our main practice, then we don't wind up being Charlatananda or following Charlatananda. Okay. One of my friends, I'll tell you this story with the next verse. Okay, the next outline is about the disadvantages of engaging in wrong paths. Okay, so such a person with a, they're talking now about this person, like the cow, you know, the other cattle who leads the first cow going into the jungle. So this person who has following a wrong teacher. Such a person with a body entwined by the savage snakes of negative mental states wanders for a very long time in the terrifying wilderness of cyclic existence whose trees are limitless beings. Okay, so this is, you know, he's creating a scene of you have a jungle, yeah, and there's somebody walking through. There's all these poisonous snakes that are wrapping themselves around them. So that's like all of our afflictive mental states that arise, you know, without any hindrance when you're following a wrong path. Yeah. So you wander in that kind of situation in this jungle where there's trees with vines that are all these other people, you know, who are also following the wrong path. And it's a terrifying wilderness of cyclic existence where you have no control, you know. You're just totally under the control of afflictions and karma. Yeah. And so through such wrong views and the aberrant behavior that's done, motivated by them, then people wander in cyclic existence, you know, for lifetime after lifetime after lifetime, you know, wanting happiness, not wanting suffering, but keeping on following the wrong path again and again and again. Yeah. So it's very sad and it's very dangerous. Okay? So we don't want to be angry at people who do this. It's really a situation for compassion and a situation to really watch our own mind and make sure that we're thinking properly about the Dharma. Okay, so Nagarjuna is really counseling those of us who want to have a meaningful life and to take the essence of our precious human life by attaining liberation and full awakening, to first seek an unmistaken path and a teacher who will teach you the unmistaken path, unmistakenly. Okay? Because without that, even though you may exert an incredible amount of effort and you may be very brave and very courageous and do all sorts of, you know, difficult ascetic practices, it's not going to get you anywhere. Okay? So he's really, warning us. Okay? So there may be, like, with the example of the cow, there may be many cows going down this path on the cliff. There may be many cows going on the path through the jungle. But there's no protection in numbers, and there's no way that they can help each other in any way. So just because everybody else is doing it doesn't mean it's a valid path. Yeah. So it's really our responsibility to think critically about the teachings, you know, not just go on emotion like, oh, this person is like, they must be Buddha. So everything they say is true, you know, this kind of thing. But think about the teachings, you know, and know what the Buddha, what is the general Buddhist discourse, and is this what the person is teaching, and if is what they're teaching making sense, and is what they're teaching you good ethical conduct, you know, if they're teaching you to do things that you know in your heart are not good, wise ethical conduct, then that should be a big wah, wah, you know, a big bell to us to, you know, to wake up and think about things, okay? If somebody's asking you to give them all your money, hold on to your wallet. You know, that's not the quality of a teacher. But what you find, you know, where people get hooked in this is their egos get hooked because inside they feel very flattered by the teacher's attention. Yeah. I had one friend, very brilliant man, he was a physicist, yeah, and he met some charlatananda who came and said, you know, you are the perfect disciple who I've been looking for forever. You know, I've wanted a disciple who I can pass everything to, who's very bright, who's very intelligent. You are that disciple. And my friend just followed that person. It's like, oh, well, he thinks I'm so good and brilliant, and you know, he's all these other people think he's wonderful, so he must be wonderful. And he followed him, you know, until he discovered that this guru was sexually abusing his two teenage daughters. And then he got smart. Yeah? So, you know, people just flattering you so that your ego feels pleased, that's not, you know, what we should fall for. And if you look, you know, when Maitreya in Sutra Alamkara, when he explained the qualities of a reliable teacher, charisma was not one of them. Yeah. But, you know, in the modern 20th century, well, and even before that, people like charisma, you know? Somebody who, with bells and whistles and, yeah, we go for charisma. Very entertaining teacher, you know, where you might have some incredible erudite Geshe, but he takes out the text and he reads the text to you and you go, boring. You know, but then there's some other guy who's like cracking jokes and, you know, walks around with this whole entourage of groupies, you know, panting, yeah, after them. So, use your own wisdom, dear, as Lama Yeshe used to tell us. Okay, questions, comments? Yeah.
I'm sorry, I have to ask, who's this Charlotte person you keep mentioning?
Charlatananda? It's charlatan.
Oh, okay.
And then Ananda is like an Indian name, many Indian gurus having the name Ananda. So you just put it together, you know.
There's actually somebody out there running around.
No, it's not. I'm not thinking of a specific person named Charlatananda. You know, it's a category of charlatans. Yeah. Yeah. So how do you repair a bankruptcy? You mean you went bankrupt and then later you have the funds and so you want to repay it? I don't know. I think then you just have to go to whoever you owed money to and, you know, they might say, but my computer system doesn't know what to do with it. Yeah. And if that's the case, then say, then tell me, you know, a charity, and I'll donate it to the charity of your choice. But, you know, if you declared bankruptcy and then later have some money and you want to repay it, then, you know, go back to whoever you owe it to.
You have no funds to repay.
Well, you do lots of prostrations and Vajrasattva. You do confession. Yeah, you do. You apply the four opponent powers. Yeah, and then you be careful with how you spend money after that. Yeah. Okay, but just the traditional way of the four opponent powers. Other questions or comments? Okay, so this teaching is very practical, isn't it? You know, this is not some erudite teaching on the nature of reality that you're all scratching your heads saying, what in the world is she talking about? You know? Yeah, it's not a non-affirming a negative, and it's not an affirming negative, and it's not a, you know, okay? So it's something we can understand, and it's something that we can put into practice right away too. Yeah, and that's really the beauty of this kind of teaching, to listen to it and then put it into practice immediately as best as we can. Yeah. Okay.
May the spiritual teacher soon lead me on the sacred path, and all spiritual friends who practice it have long life. May I pacify completely all outer and inner hindrances. Grant such inspiration, I pray. May the lives of the venerable spiritual mentors be stable, and their virtuous actions spread in the 10 directions. May the light of Losong's teachings dispelling the darkness of the beings in the three worlds always increase. Gurana mandala kamdiryatayami. Due to this merit, may we soon attain the awakened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi mind, not yet born, arise and grow. May that born of no decline, but increase forevermore. In the snowy mountain pure land, you're the source of good and happiness. Powerful Tenzin Gyatso Chenrezi, may you stay until samsara ends. May the deeds of explaining and practicing the Dharma done by groups supporting the teachings and their upholders, who spread the view of dependent arising and nonviolent actions in the 10 directions, and especially Atra Bastiavi in the west floor.